I'll have Serena send that, but next week it'll be 12:45 instead of 2 o'clock. Okay. This mini series, I guess we can call it, is in some ways a continuation of a class that some of you here were in for the whole semester. One second, I have something on my computer making noise and I have to shut down so it doesn't drive me crazy. Okay. I taught a class, just for those who weren't in the class, let me just bring you up to speed in one sentence. We had a class this year called Faith and Doubt, in which we went through the Rambam's, Ilana's cheering, in which we went through the Rambam's, I don't know if she's cheering faith or doubt, but either way, she's cheering, in which we went through the Rambam's 13, Shloshesrei Ikrei Emunah, the 13 principles of faith, and we had a lot of discussions about them, and the last two are Mashiach and Tchiyat HaMetim. These classes will build on that. But just to bring you all up to speed, Ilana, I think it was something that you said in class 2 or 3 weeks ago that really got me thinking. Because I noticed an irony that even though I've been talking about this topic for many years, it was an irony that never hit me until 2 or 3 weeks ago, which is the following. I started the class the very first day back in Elul. I started the class by going through the short summary of these 13 principles, the Ani Mamins, and asking everybody in the class to take an anonymous survey to what extent you do or don't believe in these things. And what I found, which is the exact same thing I found every time I've done this survey, is that by far, the two principles that people have the hardest time believing in are these two, Mashiach and Tchiyat HaMetim. And I then told the girls that I can honestly say that ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema in all 13 of them. And over the course of the year, we discussed all the issues and in and outs and all the things that we grapple with and what it means to believe and all that stuff I'm not going to go back to. And I also, at various points over the year, shared my own personal reflections on this. The irony that struck me, and I'm surprised that I never noticed this before, but the irony that struck me a few weeks ago when we were having this conversation on Zoom, the last class or the one before that, was that for me personally, not only is it that the things that the two principles, or particularly the one, let's talk about Mashiach, because Tchiyat HaMetim is something that we talked about in 10 minutes and I don't really understand. But Mashiach, which is the thing that people have the hardest time believing, for me, not only is it the easiest for me to accept of all 13 of them, but to a large extent, it's the reason that I'm able to believe in everything else. Because I have so much confidence in the coming of Mashiach, that's what enables me to really accept all the other things as well. And why? How can that be? Why is that? And I think a lot of it has to do with some misconceptions about what the Mashiach is. It's not that I have deeper faith than other people. It's just that I think that the reason people have a hard time believing it is that they have a hard time understanding. Now, one last point of summary, and then we're going to go over one thing we did to launch off what I want to do today. We talked about the fact that when it comes to the coming of the Mashiach and to the concepts of Tchiyat HaMetim and also Olam Haba, there's a big divide between the Rambam and many, I might even say most, of the other Rishonim. Let's look at the Rambam right now. I'm going to get it up on the screen. I should have opened this up on my computer before. Just take a second and I'll share the screen while I'm doing it. Get up Safari here. Share screen. Here we go. Okay. Here we go. Share screen. Halacha. Mishneh Torah. Lechot Barachim. All the way at the bottom. Lechot Barachim. And there we get up. Okay. the Rambam makes a number of statements. We went through this. We spent a lot of time. I'm not going to go over it now, but I want to just to like clue us in. And we can get rid of the English here. Just to clue us in on what we spoke about, I want to focus on two important comments that the Rambam made. First of all, the Rambam made a very famous comment where he says the following. Here. Al ya'ale al da'atcha she'amelach ha-mashiach tzarich lasot otot u'moftim u'mechadesh tvarim ba'olam u'mechayei meitim v'chayotzei ba'dvarim eile ein ha-davar kach. Do not think, do not believe, do not assume that the Mashiach is going to do miracles and change the laws of nature and things like that. That is not the case at all. That's one thing he said. And the other thing he said that I want to draw your attention to again is this sentence here. Amru, here, this may be a few sentences. Amru chachamim, ein ben olam hazeh limot Mashiach ela shiabud malchuyot bilvad. The rabbi said that there's no difference between the world as we live in it today and the world as it will be when Mashiach comes, except for what he calls Shiabud Malchuyot. The fact that today the Jewish people is subjected to the rule of other nations, we're in exile and we're persecuted and there's problems, that's going to change. Am Yisrael is going to be independent, we're going to have our own king. And on top of that, there'll be a general peace on earth. So there's going to be a huge historical, political development where the world is going to reach a different state of history. But nothing else is going to change. And then he goes on to explain things that sound like it, like the prophecies of the wolf and the sheep living together, etc. Those are meant to be understood as metaphors, not to be taken literally. And he also says at the end, "V'chol elu hadvarim b'chayotzi behem lo yeda adam eich yu ad sheyu." All of these things, nobody will know what's going to happen until it happens. Shadvarim stumim he meitzel hanaviim. Even the prophets were not clear; they didn't really even understand their own prophecies. Gam hachamim ein lehem kabbalah b'dvarim elu, and the rabbis also, who explained what they thought, didn't really have a tradition. They just tried to figure out what the prophecies mean. Ulefikach, he says, and therefore, yesh lehem machloket bedvarim elu. That's why there's machloket. And therefore, the Rambam says, you shouldn't really spend a lot of time trying to figure this out. What's going to happen first? What's going to happen second? What does this mean? What that mean? Ella, what should you do? Yechakeh v'yamin b'chlal ha-davar. Just wait. Believe that Mashiach's going to come, and don't get too involved in the details because we can't really know anyway. Okay, so the Rambam made here a few statements, which were a huge break from most of those who came before him and from many of those who came after him. He understood the Gemara and he understood the prophets very differently than most of those who came before him and many who came after him, in the sense that he says that when we're talking about Yimot Mashiach, we're not talking about a time when there are open miracles, and we're not talking about a time when the laws of nature change. And we're not even talking about a time when human nature changes fundamentally, just that the world reaches this state where people stop fighting with one another and they recognize the truth, and there's a Melech HaMashiach and Beit HaMikdash, which is an incredible world, very different than our world, but not in the sense of changing the laws of nature, not in the sense of fundamentally changing human nature. Okay, and that's very different, for example, from the Ramban's view. The Ramban's view basically says that when Mashiach comes, we're not going to have Yetzer Hara anymore. We're going to go back to the way we were in Gan Eden, which might even mean walking around naked like they did in Gan Eden, because there's no Yetzer Hara. And a world that basically has no, bears no resemblance to anything that we are familiar with at all. And many of the Mefarshim did understand quite literally all sorts of changes in the laws of nature. And also some of the Mefarshim spoke about things happening miraculously. For example, if the Rambam tells us that there's not going to be any changes in the laws of nature and no miracles, and the Rambam says that there will be a Beit HaMikdash, how is that Beit HaMikdash going to be built? He tells us the Mashiach is going to build it. Maybe not himself, he'll hire people, but it's going to be built like a regular building with human beings building a building. Rashi talks about a Beit HaMikdash coming down from the sky. That's miraculous. Okay, so we have this divergent view here. Okay, now, and here's what's leading up to what I want to talk to you about tonight and then the next 2 weeks as well. And ultimately, this will get back to, you know, why I'm telling you that for me, this is easier to believe than anything else, not harder to believe than anything else. If there's a question that the Rambam needed to deal with. If the Mashiach is not going to do any miracles, and if what's going to happen is going to be just a natural process and not something supernatural and no Beit HaMikdash falling from the sky and stuff like that, how are we going to know when the Mashiach is here? Meaning, if you think about it the way Rashi or the Ramban did, that question is completely irrelevant. If the Mashiach is going to be this huge supernatural upheaval where the Beit HaMikdash falls from the sky and suddenly vicious animals stop attacking each other and human beings are transformed beyond recognition, when that happens, we'll know. There won't be any confusion about it. But if the Rambam is saying, or to put it differently, if I were to walk in today and say, I'm the Mashiach, how do you know? How do you know that I'm not, you might assume that I'm, you know, mentally unstable, proclaiming I'm the Mashiach. Many, many people throughout history have claimed they're the Mashiach, and many of them have been mentally unstable. But at some point or another, if the real Mashiach is going to come, how are we going to know? So again, if the Mashiach is going to do miracles, if he's going to, like, you know, whisk a, you know, blow a shofar and suddenly all of the Jewish people are miraculously transported to Yerushalayim where they see the Beit HaMikdash coming down in fire from heaven. So if he does that, he'll be the Mashiach. And if he doesn't, he's not. But the Rambam, who is particularly talking about the Mashiach being somebody who is going to do things in a natural process. So if I told you I'm the Mashiach, you'd probably think I'm crazy. I think I mentioned one time 20-something years ago, some guy came over to me in King George Street in Yerushalayim and told me he was the Mashiach. And I did think he was crazy, and I was probably right. But what if he was actually the Mashiach? When the real Mashiach comes, how are we going to know? So the Rambam, you may recall, and we're going to read it again in a few minutes, gave us criteria which only he needs to give, right? Those who believe the Mashiach is going to do things supernaturally don't need criteria. When it happens, we'll know. Okay. So we're going to read that Rambam again in a minute. But here's what I want to do tonight and hopefully in the next two nights. I want to explore the possibility that the Mashiach might almost be here already now. Now, there are people today who make exactly that claim, that the Mashiach is here or is almost here or is in the process of coming, that we are entering the Messianic age now. And I'm aware of at least two significant groups of Jews who make that claim today for very different reasons. And we're going to look at both of them, one tonight and the other one in the next two classes. But before I get into that, let's just point out that this is by far the first time in history that people have thought that. There have been many, many, many messianic movements from the days of, at least since the destruction of the Second Temple, and maybe even before that, through today, there have been literally dozens of known examples of people who are important in, who were important, not just, not some crazy guy in King George Street, were important enough to have created movements that people follow them that we know about in the history books later. I think I may mention to you, I took a course when I was in graduate school with Dr. David Berger, the head of the Bernard Revel Graduate School in Yeshiva University, where I studied with. And I took a whole class with him on messianism and messianic movements where we went through this step by step by step. Some of these movements were very famous. One of the people who claimed he was Mashiach was a guy named Jesus. A lot of people still believe his claims. Another guy who claimed he was Mashiach, a little bit less famous, but still very well known, his name was Shabtai Tzvi. And there are dozens of others that you haven't heard of, probably. And in spite of the fact that so many times people thought the Mashiach was here and apparently were wrong, there are people making those claims today as well. And again, at some point, it's going to be, if this is really going to happen, at some point it's going to be true, and we're going to have to figure out if it's true or not. So how do we evaluate? Okay. So I want to talk tonight about one particular group of Jews today who believes a certain person is the Mashiach. I'm talking about some, many, Chabad Hasidim. Okay? Yes. Okay? Where is this picture? The Rebbe from Lubavitch? Or was that Ilana?
I read the article about, I think it was Dr. David Berger explaining how they think the Rebbe is like the Mashiach. It was so long and so informative.
He wrote a whole book on it.
Right.
So that's the same David Berger. That's the same person I'm talking about who was my teacher. Okay. Okay. First of all, we need to just I don't know how many of you know who he was, or how much do you know about him in his life? Not that much. How many of you are or will be on college campuses where a significant Jewish presence on campus is run by a Chabad person? Nobody in this group. Only Elisa. Where do you go to school, Elisa? Maryland?
Yeah, Maryland.
Is there a Chabad person? Did you know the Chabad rabbi and Rebbetzin?
Yeah, I'm very close with the Chabad family.
Do you know their particular, I don't know them. Do you know their views on Mashiach and the Rebbe? Or do they keep quiet?
I don't think that they believe that he is Mashiach, but they revere him, obviously.
He's got they have a big picture of him in their living room or something?
Actually, no.
No? Interesting. Okay, so let me start with a brief background. Okay. This man died in the year 1992. I, at that time, was in my 20s. I went to his funeral, in fact. I also had the privilege of meeting him at least twice when he was alive. So let's start with a quick background on who he was. Okay, and the reason why, it's not by accident that if you go to a college campus, the person running, or if you go anywhere in the world and you need something Jewish, it's probably a Chabad emissary was basically set up by him. Okay, so Chassidut, you know what Chassidim are, yes? The followers of Chabad or Lubavitch Chassidim. Chabad is, those are two names that mean the same thing. Lubavitch is the name of a town in Russia where they were once based. That's why they're called Lubavitchers. And Chabad is a Hebrew acronym for Chachma Bina Vedat, which their philosophy is based on. So Chabad and Lubavitch basically mean the same thing. I mean, they mean two different things, but they refer to the same group. Okay. The founder of Chabad Chassidut, who Chabad Chassidim called the Alter Rebbe in Yiddish, Rav Shneur Zalman of Lavi, was a student of a student of the Baal Shem Tov at the early days of Chassidut. And he founded the branch of Chassidut known as Chabad, which again, at one point was based in the town of Lubavitch. And there were seven Rebbes of Chabad from Rav Shneur Zalman, who lived in the 18th century, until this man, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who died, some almost 30 years ago. Okay? He became the Rebbe, I think, in the 1930s or 40s. By that time, Chabad Hasidim had moved out of Russia and they had reestablished themselves in the United States. Their headquarters is in Brooklyn, 770 Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn. He became the Rebbe, and he led Chabad Chassidut for 50 years or so, during which time he personally, this man, set up this worldwide network of sending people out to, you've seen Chabad Chassidim on street corners, telling people to put on tefillin, giving out, you've probably all at one point or another in your life been handed a because you're young women being handed candles to light on a Friday night or something, or seen people doing that. Maybe you've seen them driving around on Sukkot with lulav and etrog and all sorts of things like that. And in remote places, anywhere in the world you can go, they used to say there's two things you can find everywhere on planet Earth. One is Coca-Cola and the other is Chabad. And if a Jew finds himself today in some remote corner of this earth, needing some kosher food, a place to daven, something to help them, 9 out of 10 chances, if there's any Jewish presence there at all, it'll be Chabad. And that's all this man's work. It wasn't like that before. He set this up himself. An incredible network, worldwide network of people who go out and they live there and they try to spread Torah to the whole world. I myself am religious indirectly to a very large extent because of him. My family grew up in a non-observant home. And when my father actually was going through, when I was a little boy, my father was going through a bit of searching. We belonged to some conservative temple. And my father was interested in becoming more religious. And he wanted to move to a town where there was an Orthodox shul. We wound up moving to Livingston, New Jersey, where I grew up from the age of like 8 and on. And the shul there was run by a rabbi who's still there. He's retired now, but he still lives in Livingston, who himself was a Lubavitcher Chassid, who was sent to Livingston, New Jersey by the Rebbe. That's why when I got a bracha from the Rebbe at my bar mitzvah and again before my wedding, because, I was part of that movement of people who were brought back to Torah observance through this man's effort. He was also a brilliant person. He spoke like 8 languages. He had a PhD in engineering. He was like a special consultant to the United States Navy on engineering issues and just like all sorts of different things in addition to being this incredibly charismatic and powerful leader. Now, during his lifetime, there were a lot of people in Chabad who said this. He spoke a lot about the Mashiach also. A lot about the Mashiach. He would tell people all the time that the Mashiach is coming soon. You've heard the song, We Want Mashiach Now. He wrote it. Great lyrics, but he wrote that song. He encouraged people to sing it. The idea that one of his main messages that he spread this whole idea with, this whole worldwide movement of trying to bring Jews back to Torah, is that the Mashiach is coming soon. Even the English spelling, the way they spell it with an O, Moshiach, I think that comes from them. That's the way they spell it, right? And if you know anything about Hasidut, to begin with, so any Hasid, not just a Chabad Hasid, any Hasid, a Belzer Hasid, Babov Hasid, a Ger, they have a very strong admiration for their Rebbe, even more than the rest of us do. So every chassid, it's almost built in that a chassid is going to sort of think that his Rebbe is the Mashiach. But in this case, because you had a person who was such a charismatic leader and was such a dominant personality, and who was constantly talking about the fact that the Mashiach is coming very soon. So you have this person who becomes a leader of a movement that has hundreds of thousands of followers. And they all listen to everything he says, and he tells them the Mashiach is coming soon, the Mashiach is coming soon. Any minute the Mashiach is going to reveal himself, it's almost inevitable that his followers are going to assume that he's talking about himself. And that is, in fact, what happened. Now, there were actually 3 periods. I lived through all this. Okay, I watched this happen. We need to talk about this. So here we have a movement where you have people who are saying the Mashiach is basically here. The process is not finished. We don't have the Beit HaMikdash yet. The other Nevuot that we read about, peace on earth and all that, is not here yet. But we know who the Mashiach is. This is what they said. We know who the Mashiach is. And he has already begun the process. Now again, this is a claim that has come up before. People said it, Lahavdil, about Jesus. People said it about Shabtai Tzvi. In the Rambam, we read about Bar Kokhba, another person who none less than Rabbi Akiva thought was the Mashiach. So now we have another situation. We have a man who is very, very well respected, who's done some very impressive things, and is himself a great leader. And we have a bunch of people who are claiming, oh, this is it. This is the Mashiach that we're supposed to follow. So that's the claim we have to evaluate. What do we do when we have a situation? Now, he didn't exactly say it himself. He never came out and said, I am the Mashiach. At least not publicly. I don't know what he said behind closed doors. But he never came out and said, I am the Mashiach. He also never denied that he's the Mashiach. He heard people talking about it. I'll get to that in a second. What his own thoughts were on the matter is a mystery. But there were many people, and there still are many people, who said, this is the Mashiach. And what I want to try to do with you now is to evaluate that claim. What do we do when someone comes along and says he's the Mashiach? Or when other people say, this is the person who's the Mashiach. Now we have to examine this claim. I lived through, you weren't born yet, but I lived through three different periods of time when this claim was being made. And here's what the three periods of time were. The first period of time was most of the Rebbe's life. Okay, the Rebbe died, as Yahrzeit is actually coming up in a few weeks, Gimel Tammuz, in the year, I believe it's 1992. Maybe I'm off by a year. Maybe it was 93. Around then. I think it was 92. And he was, if I remember correctly, 91 years old when he died. 2 or 3 years before he died, in his late 80s, he had a massive stroke. In other words, he was relatively healthy until a fairly advanced age, till late 80s. He then had a massive stroke, which didn't kill him right away, but basically left him paralyzed and not really able to talk. For the last couple of years of his life, he was in a wheelchair, not really, you know, mostly paralyzed, and it's not clear to how much he understood what was going on and how much he certainly wasn't able to communicate. And then a few years after that, he died. Okay? So we have to look at three periods of time. There was the period of time for most of his life until the stroke, when he was active and involved and leading the movement. Then there was a relatively short period of time when he was still alive, but no longer actually leading because he was not any more capable of doing so. And then there's the period following his death. At all three of those periods, there were people who said he was the Mashiach. Now, for the first period of time, there was a very strange situation where you have this leader who's, like I said, extremely charismatic, extremely impressive, and leading a worldwide movement that he has built, which to this day is you know, the revolution that it created is really impressive. It's one of the reasons that people say, look what he's doing. He's bringing them. He is the Mashiach. Look what he's doing. He's sending people to, you know, to the Philippines to find the lost Jews in the Philippines and bring them back. And he's sending people to Texas, and he's sending people to Russia and everywhere around the world. Look what he's doing. He's the Mashiach. He himself was constantly talking about the Mashiach. He used to say the Mashiach is going to come bekarov mamish, really, really soon. The Hebrew word mamash, really soon. His followers said, you know what it is? Well, you know why he keeps saying bekarov mamash? Because mamash is, his followers claimed, some of them, is an acronym. That was his initials. Menachem Mendel Schneerson, mamash. He's hinting to himself. So they claim. Like I said, he never said he was the Mashiach. He never denied that he was the Mashiach. And he basically told people that they're not allowed to talk about it. Of course, they did anyway. One of his followers wrote a whole book filled with proof upon proof upon proof in his mind, quoting all sorts of statements from the Gemara and Midrashim to prove that, in fact, this is the Mashiach. And he prohibited, when he found out about the book that the guy was going to publish, the guy wrote a book that he was about to publish. And when the Rebbe found out about it, the Rebbe issued an order, you're not allowed to publish the book. In Chabad, if the Rebbe gives an order, you have to follow it. So the book wasn't published at that point. Okay, so let's pause for a minute. Then we'll talk about the next two stages. But let's go back in time. Let's imagine that we were having this conversation 35 years ago when I was in high school. Okay, 1984, 1985, something like that. The Rebbe's alive. The Rebbe's healthy. The Rebbe's leading this worldwide movement. People are whispering, this is the Mashiach, this is the Mashiach, this is the Mashiach. He's not coming out and saying, you're wrong, I'm not the Mashiach. He's just saying, you're not supposed to talk about it. You're not supposed to talk about it. You're not supposed to talk about it. Don't talk about it. Don't talk. Mashiach is coming. Mashiach is coming. Rebbe, is it you? We don't talk about it. Okay, so they say, okay, he doesn't want to say it yet, but we're sure he's the Mashiach. Let's say we were living back then, as I was. None of you were born in 1985, right? I don't think so. Okay. What? But let's pretend it's 1985 and we're having this conversation. How do you evaluate this idea? How do you evaluate this claim? How do we begin to know if he's Mashiach or not? So if we are non-Rambam people, if what we're waiting for is some sort of miraculous, spontaneous, you know, he's going to blow a shofar and we're going to all be whisked miraculously. We're going to land in Yerushalayim and watch the Beis HaMikdash come down from the sky in fire. So then either it'll happen or it won't. But what if we're Rambam people?
Rabbi Akiva.
Okay. So the Rambam, very good, Alana. So the Rambam gave us, no, that's not it, here. The Rambam gave us criteria. Here's what he said. Okay. Alana remembers that we read the following. This is, I started reading this before, we're going to read it again. You can see my pointer, right? Yeah? Okay. Again, don't think Shemelech HaMashiach Tzarich Hasot Otzot Moftim Mechadesh Tvarim Ba'olam Mechayim Eitim Mechayot Zeh Bedvarim Eilu Eina Davar Kach. That's not the case. How do we know? Sharei Rabbi Akiva Chacham Gadol Michachmei Mishnah Haya. Rabbi Akiva was a great, one of the greatest of our Chachamim at the time of the Mishnah. V'hu Haya Nosei Kelam Shal Ben Kozi V'Hamelech. And Rabbi Akiva supported Bar Kochba in his rebellion against the Romans. Rabbi Akiva said that Bar Kochba is the Melech HaMashiach. And Rabbi Akiva and many of the other scholars of that generation thought that Bar Kochba was Mashiach. Ad sheneherag bavonot, until he was killed. Kevan sheneherag, once he was killed, no dalehem sheino. It becomes clear that he wasn't. But they never asked him for to do any miracles. This is the Rambam's proof that the Mashiach is not supposed to do miracles. Because if the Mashiach was supposed to do miracles, how could you even think Bar Kochba is the Mashiach? He didn't do miracles. So therefore it proves that the Mashiach is not supposed to do miracles. And then the Rambam goes on and says, okay, so now how are you supposed to know who the real Mashiach is? And he gives us criteria. Ve'im yamod melech mi beit David. If a king arises who's a descendant of David, hogeh b'Torah v'osek b'mitzvot k'David David, and he is a scholar of Torah and he's involved in doing mitzvot like David, his ancestor, was. K'vitor shebichtav v'shebalpeh. He follows not just the written Torah but also the oral Torah. We pointed out that's probably meant specifically to disqualify Jesus, who didn't apparently follow the oral Torah, at least not completely, right? And this king doesn't just follow the Torah himself, but he forces other people, or he encourages other people. It says here, he forces other people to follow the Torah. He'll fight wars on behalf of Hashem. If that happens, then you see those things, you're supposed to assume that he's the Mashiach. We pointed out that the Rambam got this from the precedent of Bar Kochba. All these things are describing Bar Kokhba. This is exactly what Rabbi Akiva saw when he made that decision that this must be the Mashiach. He saw a king who was believed to be from the house of David, who was religious and was scholarly and was leading other people and enforcing the Torah's laws and was fighting wars. He got an army together and he rebelled against the Romans to liberate the Jewish people from the Romans. So when you see all those things, you're supposed to believe that this is to be assumed to be the Mashiach. Im asav etzliach, if he succeeds, uvana mikdash bimkomo, and he finishes the job, rebuilds the Beit HaMikdash, kibetz nitchei Yisrael. So he wins the wars. Again, step one is when you see this king who's doing all these great things and fighting the wars, you're supposed to assume that this is probably the Mashiach. Just like Rabbi Akiva did. Not even probably. You're supposed to assume this is the Mashiach, even though you know that it's not definite yet. Just like Rabbi Akiva did. Then, if he succeeds in his mission, he actually wins the war, defeats all the enemies, rebuilds the Beit HaMikdash, and brings all the Jews back from exile, then arayz Mashiach bevadai. Then you know for sure that it, right? So when you see someone starting the process and gets to a certain point, you're supposed to assume that this is the Mashiach, like Rabbi Akiva did. If he finishes the process, wins the wars, builds the Beis HaMikdash, and brings the Jews back from Galut, then you know the Mashiach is here, bevadai. Vim lo etzliach ad ko. But if he ultimately doesn't succeed, o neharag, or he's killed, biyadua she'eino zeh shetich alav Torah, then you know retroactively that this wasn't the Mashiach. Okay. Just like Rabbi Akiva ultimately found out that Bar Kokhba wasn't the Mashiach. We also talked about whether it's that Rabbi Akiva was wrong, or maybe Bar Kokhba maybe could have been the Mashiach. Maybe the problem wasn't Rabbi Akiva. Maybe the problem was the others who didn't follow him. That's part of the dilemma. But in any case, ultimately, it turned out that Bar Kokhba wasn't. So when you see something that reaches the first stage, you meet those criteria, then you have a chezkat Mashiach. You have an assumption that this is the Mashiach. And when he finishes the job, then you know it's bevadai. If, and if not, then he's not. The year's 1985. We're sitting around talking about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. People saying he's the Mashiach. And I ask you, what do we think? Well, let's use the Rambam's criteria.
You're, I mean, shouldn't we say that during the time that they were thinking that while he was alive, that could be something plausible, but after he died, say, okay,
we'll get to that after he died. Let's pretend it's 1985 right now. If we were having this conversation in 1985, after everything I described to you, and you look at this Rambam, what do you have to say?
You probably should have believed that he was Mashiach.
Why?
Well, because he's fighting against, you know, Jews. Like, he's fighting, like, I don't know exactly how to say it, but, like, he's fighting a good Jewish fight. Like, there's not, like, a particular enemy that he's fighting against, but he's sort of trying to bring in more Jews. So it feels like that's sort of something that the Mashiach would do.
So you're saying in 1985 you would have followed him and said this is the Mashiach?
Yeah.
Anybody disagree with Shoshi? So let me tell you about a conversation I had with somebody. I don't remember if it was in 1985, but it was around then, maybe a couple of years later. I was talking to a Chabad Chassid who said the Rebbe is the Mashiach. I said, listen, I have great respect for the Rebbe, and I did. I myself am an observant Jew because of him. By the way, I even had a bracha from the Rebbe read under my chuppah. When I talk to Chabad people, that's like giving me some credence. In my wedding album, I even have a picture of the letter being read and, like, in the background, the picture of the Rebbe in my album. But I said, I think it's very irresponsible, I said to this person, for you to say he's the Mashiach. I said, what do you mean? There's all these sources. He's doing all these things. I said, how can you be so sure? Listen, I said, I'm not going to say he's not the Mashiach. And if he, you know, leads us all to Yerushalayim and, you know, and builds the Beis HaMikdash, I'll be right there with him and I'll be thrilled. But how can you say he's the Mashiach? I'm not saying he's not. I'm saying you don't know. He said, I'll prove it to you. I said, I'll prove to you you can't say that. He'll say, I'll prove to you I can. I said, I'm going to pull out a book and show you why you're wrong. He said, I'm going to pull out a book and show you why you're right. We both go to a bookshelf and we both pull out the exact same source. I pointed to this Rambam and he pointed to this Rambam. I said, the Rambam, let's read it. I said, V'im Yamod Melech. I said, the Rambam's talking about a king. He's not talking about a rabbi in Brooklyn. He's talking about a king. He says he is a king. The problem is people like you don't follow the king. He's the Melech. I said, Mi Beit David. It says he has to be a descendant of David. This guy said he is. I said, how do you know? He says, we have a tradition. Can you prove he's not? Okay, let's read on. Hogeba Torah. He has to be a scholar of Torah. Okay, I'll give you that one. Osik b'mitzvot. I'll give you that one. Torah shebichtav and Torah shebal peh. Okay. I'm starting to get a little, you know, nervous here. Yikof kol Yisrael leleich bo lechazek bidka. He'll force all the Jews to follow the Torah. How do you evaluate that? On the one hand, he didn't force anybody to do anything. He didn't reach all the Jews. On the other hand, I think it's safe to say that there is no one person who's done a fraction of what he did to bring Jews back to Torah. Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even more, I don't know how to count it, have been influenced by a movement that he started and he ran single-handedly. He has thousands of shluchim around the world, but they were all sent by him. When he was alive, he sent each person personally. If there was a Chabad guy in Bangkok back then, it's because the Rebbe personally sent him to Bangkok. And the guy in, I don't know, Sao Paulo was sent there by the Rebbe personally. He said, you're going to Sao Paulo. That's the way it worked. Okay. V'yilachem milchamot Hashem. I said, okay, but now you got it. He's not fighting wars. I said, we have an army in Israel that's fighting the wars, and he's sitting in Brooklyn doing really important work, but he's not fighting wars. I said, what do you mean? He's v'yilachem milchamot Hashem. He's fighting the wars of God. What are the wars of God other than what you said, Shoshi? He's fighting against assimilation, and he's fighting against ignorance, and he's fighting to bring back every lost Jew. He's fighting God's wars. Look, the guy said he has every criteria of the Rambam. I said, look, the Rambam was, that's very creative reading, but the Rambam was talking about Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba was a melech. He overthrew the Romans and he ruled an independent country for 2.5 years. When Rabbi Akiva made these statements, until the Romans came back. But when Rabbi Akiva made these statements, he was a melech. We have coins with his name on it. Like they put the king's name on the coin. He fought wars with swords. That's what the Rambam's talking about. He's not talking about a rabbi who you call a king who's doing really important work fighting spiritual wars. Okay, who's more convincing, me or the Chabad guy? 1985. Okay. Open question. Fine. Somewhere around 1990, I told you the Rebbe had a debilitating stroke. And he never really recovered from that stroke. During that time, it was unclear to what extent they would pull him out in his wheelchair. They used to have these things they called in Yiddish Fabringen, which is like a big gathering, like a tish, basically. I went to one of those even. You saw the Rebbe sitting up there on the stage in a wheelchair. And, you know, it's hard to know, you know, people were singing and he was like tapping his finger with the music. They claimed that they could ask him questions and he could, with his eyes blink and like communicate somehow. Unclear what the Rebbe really. Now, those few years became the peak of the, because basically everything that had been kept under the surface then now burst out into the open. As long as the Rebbe was, on the one hand, he was still alive, and the issues we're going to have to deal with after he died hadn't happened yet. He was still alive. On the other hand, he was no longer able to tell people you're not allowed to talk about it. So that book that 15 years earlier the Rebbe prohibited the guy from publishing, during this time after the Rebbe's stroke, he published the book that he wrote 15 years earlier or 20 years earlier. And everyone was saying that this is it. This is like the last stages. The Rebbe has to like, they had all these explanations where he's like, you know, in this weak physical state because he's fighting all these spiritual wars. And then very soon he's going to hop out of his wheelchair and say, okay, let's go. We're, follow me. We're going to Yerushalayim right now. And this is where the height of the movement really reached its height. This was back in the 1980s. We didn't have cell phones yet, but they had beepers. You know what beepers were? These little things that doctors used to carry, whatever. Some guy in Crown Heights in Brooklyn set up a business called Mashiach Beepers. You could pay a certain amount of money and you would get a beeper that you could walk around with. And they promised that when the Rebbe gets out of his wheelchair and announces, that's it, it's time, we're going to Yerushalayim, that they're going to push a button right there in 770 and you'll be among the first to get the message. All you have to do is pay $19.90 a month or whatever it is and you get your beep, Mashiach beeper. Big business ad going on. And then, so at that point, the conversation is, I guess, essentially the same conversation, except that the Rebbe himself is not there saying stop. That's why it reached its crescendo. And then on Gimel Tammuz, he died. Now what?
I mean, like Bar Kokhba, you're supposed to say, okay, if he died, he can't be the Mashiach.
So before moving on, I want to tell you a quick story. During those years, I was a high school teacher. I lived in Muncie at that time. And I was a teacher in a girls' high school in Muncie that, unfortunately, a really nice school that no longer exists. That's for another time. And I taught a number of courses. And one of the classes I taught was Jewish history. One day, I was teaching a course to 11th grade class. And we were talking about the 16th century, and that's where we're up to in Jewish history. And I was talking about Shabtai Tzvi. I don't know how much you know about Shabtai Tzvi. It's a fascinating, very troubling chapter in Jewish history. This man, 500 years ago, managed to convince a lot of people he was the Mashiach, and he had Jews across the world believing him and caused a lot of damage, ultimately. And we were learning about this period in history. And after class, this is during that 2.5 years when the Rebbe was very sick after his stroke, but he was still alive. After class, a girl comes over and says, Rabbi Haber, I need to talk to you. Really wonderful girl who was from a family that had connections to Chabad. I don't know if she, her father was like, had been Chabad and they moved a little bit away from it, but they were very religious and they had like a lot of relatives that were really into Chabad. She said to me, I'm worried about something. She said, you know, there are these people, you know, we're talking about these people. You were teaching us, Rabbi Haber, about these people who were so convinced that this guy, Shabtai Tzvi, had been the Mashiach. And I'm thinking about my cousins who are so convinced that the Rebbe is the Mashiach. She said to me, if Chas V'Shalom, this was her words, if Chas V'Shalom, the Rebbe dies, what's going to happen to those people? And I said to her, I don't know. I told her, listen, if the Rebbe gets out of his wheelchair and announces he's the Mashiach and leads us all to Yerushalayim and builds the Beit HaMikdash, I'll be right there with him and I'm be thrilled like anybody. But I told her, I think it's irresponsible to say that, etc. And she said to me, so what's going to happen if Chas V'Shalom he dies? I said to her, I don't know. But if that, God forbid, happens and he dies, I'm telling you that you're going to find at least some people who are going to say either that he isn't really dead or that he maybe he's dead, but he's coming back. That's what people are going to say. That was the end of that conversation. That was like March or April. That summer, Gimel Tammuz, the Rebbe died. The next year, in September, first day of school, this girl's now, I think she was in 10th grade, now she's in 11th or 11th, 12th. Come to school the very first day of school in September, and we teach during the first recess break at like 11 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was, the first day of school. She comes running over to me in the hall, this girl, Rabbi Haber, Rabbi Haber, Chana, how are you? How was your summer? Great, I got to talk to you about something. She said, do you remember we had a conversation like 4 months ago when I asked you if the Rebbe dies and you said, I said, yeah, I remember that conversation a little bit. She said, how did you know? How did you know? And I said to her, I knew because I've studied history. It has to happen. When people believe something so strongly and they're faced with absolute evidence, look, he died. He didn't build the Beit HaMikdash and now he's dead. So we all know that that's it. But that means you have to face the fact that what you believe with Emunah Shleima is just wrong. It's so difficult. You're going to come up with some kind of theory that you don't have to say that. Because that's what happened. Happened to Shabtai Tzvi. It certainly happened. That's the whole basis of Christianity, is exactly that belief, second coming. And there are other examples too. And that's exactly what happened. I have here, if anyone wants, I can, actually, it's not. This is not the best. There are other places that are better than this webpage, but there are these sources that they put out. They've come up with these books and all sorts of things where they find all these abstract midrashim about how the Tchiyat HaMetim is going to happen as part of the coming of the Mashiach. According to Rambam, we said that's definitely not true. Notice they'll follow the Rambam when it suits them, and when it doesn't suit them, they suddenly deviating from the Rambam. And you have people that are believing that a person who's dead is going to come back from the dead and be the Mashiach. And this is where Dr. Berger wrote his book that you are talking about, Ilana. Because it sounds really scary how similar it winds up being to Christianity. You talk about a dead person coming back from life, Mashiach coming back from the dead, a second coming. It's exactly. And we're basically out of time, so I won't go on too much further, but let's put it this way. This movement within Chabad, and the problem is that, and if you do wind up, I'll tell you one story in a second about that. But there's a big machloket in Chabad right now about this issue. They call the Mashiachistim, the ones who believe he's a Mashiach, and the non-Mashiachistim. There are very few Chabad Hasidim that will actually look you in the eyes and say the Rebbe is not the Mashiach. A lot of them won't even say he's dead. There are Chabad Hasidim that will not use the expression Zatzal, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, when speaking about the Rebbe. I've seen Chabad Hasidim even using expressions like Shlita, which means may he live a long life, in referring to someone who passed away 25 years ago. And it's dangerous because it can deteriorate into even more radical things. And there are, and I hope and believe that this is really a small fringe, but there are places where it has crossed the line from Mashiach into something worse, into something that might even be called idolatry. Now, David Berger, my professor, he wrote this book. When I was in his class that I was talking about before, this was before the Rebbe died. This was in the class was in the 1980s also. Years later, he came out and he wrote this book. And needless to say, a lot of people in Chabad were very unhappy with him. So one last story, okay? This story happened about somewhere between 10 and 15 years ago when I was in MMY, I was director of MMY back then. And I was teaching a class in Machshevet Yisrael. And we taught this topic. We're talking about the Mashiach, the exact same Rambam, basically the class I just gave you now, more or less, because it came up. And I came out and I said, listen, with all due respect, and I have tremendous, I gave the whole disclaimer, everything I told you about how I have such respect for what he did, but I said, I think at this point, while he's alive, we can have a machloket about it. The Rambam specifically said, by the way, they'll say, the Rambam says if he's killed, not if he dies of a stroke. So he said, the Rambam says if he's killed, you know he's not the Mashiach. Right? Notice that when it was talking about fighting wars, they have no problem reading things, you know, very metaphorically. When it's on their, you know, when it doesn't suit them, and suddenly it has to be exactly to the letter, exactly what he says. So I came out and I even mentioned David Berger. I had recently read his book. I said, this man was my professor and he's really, really, really harif and he really thinks it's a terrible thing. And he says, you have to not. So these two girls came over to me after class and they said, listen, both of us, next year are planning to go to, they were both planning to go to a college, not the same college. They were each planning to go to a college in the States, two different ones, where the only shul, the only Orthodox presence on campus is Chabad. So they said, what do you think we should do? You're telling us that like these Chabad people, so I said, well, suddenly, in other words, basically I was suddenly faced with a dilemma that was no longer abstract and theoretical. Right, I was talking about how, listen, with all due respect, that this belief is not acceptable when you have to distance yourself from it. It's not mainstream halacha. It doesn't follow halacha. I don't think it's certainly against the Rambam. I think it's against almost all other sources. And I don't think that this is our belief. And I'm not even sure we can call this Orthodox Judaism. I mean, you have to be careful. And I'm talking theoretically, sitting in Yerushalayim, talking about this. And now these girls said, listen, you know, I'm going to this campus. And that's my kosher dining room. And that's my shul. And that's my rabbi. And you're telling me now. So suddenly I was faced with a question which is no longer abstract and theoretical. I said, okay, I have to look into this more. I'm going to get back to you. And then I went and I did two things. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, that's how, was also still alive. And ultimately I knew I was going to have to go to my Rebbe and ask him. But I wanted to like understand the issue better first. So first, I wrote an email to Dr. Berger. And I said, Dr. Berger, I don't know if you remember me. I was in your class so many years ago. I have this question. He wrote back, of course I remember you. And I said, just curious, what would you tell these girls? He's a frum man, Dr. Berger. He's a rabbi also. And he said, if you're asking me my opinion, I would instruct them. I think he said to me, I think you, they're asking you, their rabbi, you should tell them that they should each go over to the Chabad rabbi on campus and ask him if he's willing to make the declaration that's found on page 27 of my book or whatever it is, where he has this text that he wants. Basically, he was trying to get all the, he wrote letters to all kinds of big rabbis, Dr. Berger, it's all in his book, and to rabbinic organizations, to the OU and the RCA and the Rabbanut in Israel and the Badats and all these things. He wanted to get like Chabad rabbis basically outlawed, that you can't rely on them for kashrus or anything else, unless they're willing to make this declaration, which basically says, I hereby declare that the Rebbe is dead and he's not the Mashiach. Most Chabad Hasidim will not be willing to say that. So he said to me, if you want, even those that don't actively say Mashiach, Mashiach, if you say to them, will you agree to this statement? He said, I would tell those girls that they should each go over to the Chabad rabbi on their campus and ask him if he's willing to agree to this sentence and this paragraph in my book. And if he does not agree, then you should tell them that they are on a campus that has no Orthodox shul, and they should conduct themselves accordingly. Because the only so-called Orthodox shul is being run by this person who... I said, okay, now I understand David Berger's position. Now I need a psak. I'm not gonna go tell them that without... So I went to Rav Lichtenstein, who Baruch Hashem was still alive. I was able to ask him. In the book, Dr. Berger includes Rav Lichtenstein as one of the rabbis that he sent this, that he made this request to, that he was hoping would support him. He wanted these organizations to all come out and basically ban Chabad unless, you know, and they didn't. They came out with statements, but they fell far short of what Dr. Berger wanted. And Rav Lichtenstein told me the same thing. He said, look, Berger is on a crusade. That's what he said. I'm not. I agree with him that it's a cause of great concern, but I would not tell the girls that. You should tell them that this belief is problematic, it's not conventional, but this rabbi is doing wonderful work, and if that's the shul, and if that's the kosher food, they should go. So I said, Rebbe, I said to Rav Lichtenstein, I said, Rebbe, I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you telling me that if somebody believes, oh, he said to me, the belief that the Rebbe is the Mashiach is probably wrong. That was his words, probably wrong, but it's not heresy. So I said, I want to make sure I understood this, Rebbe. Are you telling me that if somebody believes the Mashiach is going to get out of his grave, come back from the dead, lead us to Yerushalayim, build the Beit HaMikdash, and become the Melech HaMashiach, that person is probably wrong, but is not a heretic. He's not a kofar. Rav Lichtenstein thought about it for a second, and he said, yes, that's what I'm saying, provided, this is very interesting what he said, provided that he doesn't think the Rebbe will do that of his own volition. Meaning, if he believes that God is going to resurrect the Rebbe, bring the Rebbe back from the dead and make him the Mashiach, that's probably wrong, but he's not a kofar. If he thinks the Rebbe himself can decide to bring himself back from the dead, that means he's already considering the Rebbe to be something more than a human being. And that already is out of bounds. So that's what I told the girls. And that's what I'll tell you also. So that's where we stand on this issue. The reason that these organizations, I think, did not take what Dr. Berger wanted them to do. Dr. Berger came, read his book, it's fascinating. He talks about how he himself had such respectable Babacher Rebbe. He had personal interactions with him when he was alive, etc. But also, this is his life's work. He is a historian whose specialty is actually not Mashiach stuff. He taught that, but his main issue is Jewish-Christian relations and the arguments between Jews and Christians in the Middle Ages. This is what he lives. And he says, basically, you're breaking it all down. There's no difference anymore. You're going to become Christian, essentially. One of the things he mentioned is in his book, you know, there's an organization called Jews for Jesus. You've heard of it? Apparently, at one point in Los Angeles, they put up a billboard shortly after the Rebbe died when this was all going on. Huge billboard with the Rebbe, put up by Jews for Jesus, with the Rebbe's picture and the slogan, right idea, wrong man. So that's where this issue stands. At the same point, though, Chabad, we talked already in Faith and Doubt about how, you know, there's principles, but the details, there's a lot of times disagreement on. You have the Rambam, you have the Ramban, you have all these different... Most people, I think, took Rav Lichtenstein's approach. We have to distance ourselves from that belief, but we're not ruling these people out. We're not saying that they're not Orthodox Jews, and all the, this, you know, the entire life's work of the Rebbe and all, everything he built and what he's doing for Jews around the world, and for some of you on campus, as a direct point of that, you know, so that's that issue. Okay. One last sentence. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, and the week after, I want to look at a different movement. A movement that's a lot closer to my heart and probably to all of yours, which also believes that the Mashiach, or at least some people, are making the claim that the Messianic era, the Yemot HaMashiach, are upon us, even though they're not pointing to a person. And that's religious Zionism, at least many within the religious Zionist community, who believe that without pointing to a person like the Chabad Hasidim did, and that maybe is part of the problem, because if this is Yemot Mashiach, so who's the Mashiach? We have to talk about that too. But to question whether what we're living through today in Medinat Yisrael is connected to those Nevuot, and if it is, what is the relationship between them? So that's what we will talk about, Bezrat Hashem. Okay? So next week it'll be at 12:45. I'll have Serena send out a notice about that. All right. Comments? Okay.
Thank well, you.
This was fun. Nice to see you all.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Haber.
Thank you.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.
Thank you.